Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking corn silage dry downs. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at some new soybean products found at the Farm Progress Show. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of the Farm Progress Show. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Football is back. The first game last night.
It's back.
Beginning of the season has occurred.
Yeah. Hawk to a game right away.
Hawk to a game, yes. Is that what they're calling it?
Hawk to a game. I am calling it that. Hawk to a game.
They were showing Hawk to a Girl last night, so she did.
Was she at the game?
I don't remember.
Maybe she gave him some pointers, like, you got to spit on that jersey right there.
That's how you get him kicked out.
But, yeah. Some potentially good news for the Packers. Got Micah Parsons. Hopefully he plays as well as we all think he's going to, as the hype train is building it up to be. So
it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It is cool when you get a player like that out of, you always heard rumors. And
out of a rival, really. I mean,
right.
Dallas
the
is
Cowboys
a
are.
They always are have been since the Favre days, at least.
Yes.
If not, you know, you go back to the Ice Bowl. That was Packers-Cowboys. So, I mean, there's a long history between those two teams. And for Jerry to just be like, nah, whatever. That's, I mean, good for us, hopefully.
They didn't really give up a ton.
I thought they gave up a ton and paid a lot. But that's what all this is now. It's crazy what they get paid. It's crazy what stuff.
For the expectation of what he should be. I mean, you're going to have to give up more.
Right. That's a good way to say it, too. We're paying now for expectations, not for results.
Yep.
So it is a difficult league that way where yes, it's more money is guaranteed now to all these players than ever before. So.
And it's not like, remember, we were all like, oh, J.J. Watt was going to come, right, a couple years ago.
Yeah.
He was going to come to the Packers, and then he never was. But anyhow, he was old at that time. This guy's not. Like, he's still in his early 20s, I think. So he's got a long ways to go. So that's also what you're going to benefit from.
I think it was Jake Shue made the comment that we gave up our oldest player for Micah.
Right.
Nice.
Which isn't saying a lot because the Packers are a young team. But
it is a good point of, like, you are...
We're trading age for youth a little bit.
And you figured he was... They probably weren't going to... I think he was a free.
He was almost, there was one.
Yeah, he was
left
toward the end of his contract, yeah.
No, it'll be fun. It's always fun when the real season starts, not preseason, not, you know, practice. This is where it's real football again.
Yeah, preseason for me is just kind of falling off the...
Oh, it's
the wagon, like...
It's not even watchable.
Not really worth watching.
Surprising, I would say. I went to a preseason game last year, and that was actually a lot of fun because there's no expectation. You don't care if they win or lose.
Right.
You just kind of watch the you can go
get
to the bathroom and it's fine. Right. So that was, but on I didn't watch any preseason football on TV because it's not a TV.
You don't have to wear six layers like you do later.
It actually was quite hot. It was actually the worst.
Most of the preseason games would have been pretty warm.
It was warm.
And a lot of kids go to those games. So you're not like squished in there like you are with regular season game.
It was my daughter's first game and she enjoyed it. It was fun. And that too, we got to talk about. At that game, the kickers were battling back and forth. We didn't know who was going to be our kicker, which I think neither of them
they were not
being our kicker at the end of the season. But it still was fun to say, like, hey, that's what they're watching for is who's doing better with that. And you're right, it is not. Like, you have so much room in there, which is nice. So, yeah. But we're at real football now.
It's go time.
And it feels like football weather out there.
Yeah. No, we had the temperature drop off, so. Feels like fall.
40s at night. Crazy.
Even to yesterday, I don't remember what the high was, but it wasn't very warm. today, I think it's like in the 50s.
And windy, so you get
windy, so just, yeah, it's going to feel cold.
Push it, yeah.
It's going to feel like October out there today. But did you guys get your Powerball tickets?
I got my last one. I didn't get
a losing ticket.
I lose. Oh, I won $16.
Well, that's pretty good. Yep. What are you going to do with all that? Reinvest.
Reinvest in tomorrow's drawing.
Ching ching. He was walking through the Quick Trip. Woo!
Yeah,
$16.
The lady that cashed me out with the tickets, she was pretty excited for me. So.
That's good.
I just assume you bought it and took it back to a Quick Trip, but.
It's fair. Not the same one, but.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to go to the same one.
No.
That's the nice thing about.
I bought it in Kaukauna and cashed it out in De Pere.
Yeah. Third highest ever jackpot right now. So yeah. We'll see if.
That surprises
$1.7 billion.
I feel like it should be the largest. I don't remember.
It was up.
No, there was a two.
Yeah,
oh, there
was just over two, and then this will be very close to the second largest.
It wasn't that long ago. The two.
No, the two was almost exactly 2 years ago.
Is that what it was? Yeah.
Do you buy Powerball every time, every week, all the time?
No, usually when it gets high.
What's your number? What does it have to be?
It seems like it used to be over 500 million. You'd yeah. Like, it, now cool. It's like a billion before people are, I feel like, before you're like, oh, yeah, holy man.
I think I bought my first one this time around when it hit 700
okay.
million. Because, yeah, that would have been, so I think I've bought them three times now. So the 700 million, and it was the first time over a billion in this last one. So.
What do you drop, like $20 or?
No.
200?
No.
Like eight.
I'm a $6 for some random reason. Yeah, I don't know why. Part of it is like I think usually I start with like 10 and then depending what I win, I'll reinvest.
I can't go out to eat for $8. So like I guess that's my line of like
line.
If I could do more with it, like obviously if it's I didn't buy the three tickets, I could have gone and had a nice meal. But yeah. You know, it's. I guess
so you have a poor meal, and then
that's my line of go. Like, yeah. That's why I don't spend 20 or 50 or.
Can't get my $7 meal at DQ, so yeah. I'll just. Pop it
I did hear McDonald's is bringing back the extra value meal. I don't know how cheap it'll be, nice. But it's supposed to be
extra value.
So,
it won't be. McDonald's is expensive.
Everything's expensive.
Everything's expensive, but I would agree with Bill. For McDonald's food.
Oh yeah.
You go there and like the Happy Meal is probably. Cheap, really. Still, everything else is not.
Even those are like $6 or $7 yeah. now.
But it kids, that's pretty cheap for a kids' meal at this point. I can't think of a cheaper.
I wonder if you took the volume of food like at Culver's and put the volume like for the same amount of money. McDonald's has to be half the volume of food,
right? Especially your burgers. Like your fries are probably comparable because Culver's has bigger fries, so you get less of them in a.
Oh, and they're not. Culver's fries are trash. Out of anything that's Culver's, their fries need a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything else is.
You just got to dip them in the cheese sauce, like drown them in cheese sauce. They're better. But yeah, no, I all fast food, like.
You're right, man. Everything's expensive.
Expensive and not great quality. Even. I've had a couple bad Culver's meals over the last year.
Ooh.
Whoa. Ooh. Hot take.
It was.
Wow, next you're going to.
We were driving
trash Quick Trip
through Illinois. It was
Illinois Culver's. That's not even a real Culver's.
I'm pretty sure it's still the same franchise.
I'm sure Craig Culver's realizes that Illinois. I mean, you had to go. You probably just had to pay a bunch of tolls on a tricky app that nobody can understand, and then you pull off to a Culver's, and that's like an away game, an away stadium. It just doesn't
wow! Count. I didn't realize you were. How deep are you into Culver's? Like, no. Is that your lottery?
I like Culver's. It's just, yeah.
I like it, too, but they can screw up, too. Yes, like,
yeah.
I don't like it when my cheese curds taste like onion rings.
They are going to do a unique size where I'm sure quality control will be a lot.
Right.
You know, they're huge. You see them everywhere now.
I've noticed they used to put that little paper thing over the burger in the box to keep the grease kind of. Now the boxes just get like, you pull it out of the bag, it's like soaked in grease. And that, you got to watch where you set it.
Shout out to Craig Culver. Matt will be the secret shopper if you'd like.
There is actually, I think, a Facebook group. Like, they rate Culver's. So a guy I knew in college was, like, big on that. Like, yeah, well, I'm a part of this group. Like, I think Culver's really listens to us. Like, okay, sure. But no, nobody's perfect. I prefer Culver's to most other fast food. I'm not saying that the franchise as a whole is bad.
One nice part about Culver's is it is that borderline where it's not as fast foody as fast food, which is nice. I mean, it still technically is.
Slow fast food.
Well, not even the speed. The quality of food does seem better.
Yeah.
So you're, Bill, you're like a $20 in guy.
I had a 20.
Maybe I got to up my, with inflation here. Or whatever happened to the old like company pool thing? Do we like?
I don't know if anybody's like, nobody wants to split it anymore.
Yeah.
But this amount, I feel like it wouldn't be a bad. Like on farms out there, I wonder if they're, you know, you throw in, then if.
What did we say? It was like 700 million was what you take home?
Yeah, the payout was like 770, I think, with this jackpot. It's 1.7. It's basically.
So if 10 of us went in, you wouldn't take 70 million?
No, I would. That's what I think that'd be better anyway, because then as well as there's this expectation of when you win that all your friends, family, everybody's going to come out of the woodwork wanting some of the money.
Well,
whereas if you pooled with all,
I think the problem with the pool family was you'd get the guy, like you had the designated like buyer guy, who would go and like buy it. And cause I remember seeing things where like groups would win and like that guy's like, no, this is my ticket. Like, Because how do you manage that? Like, if I go and I buy the pool money or the pool ticket and then I buy my own ticket.
Right.
And I went on my ticket.
There's been, like, a ton of lawsuits on that. You're right, man. And so, yes, if you go in a pool, you basically cannot buy your own ticket.
Right. You could even extend that to, you know, your wife buys a ticket and you buy the pool ticket. And then people are still going to think that you're screwed.
You're right. That probably is the downside of the company pool that kind of killed it, where you're just like.
Like. Regardless, you have to share it, apparently.
Yeah.
No matter how it gets won. Because, I think there was a whole thing where people were, like, taking pictures of the ticket and sending it to everybody so everybody knew what the numbers were.
Sure, this is our.
So that you weren't like, oh. But, yeah.
Do you guys go to the back of Quick Trip and get the little card to fill out your numbers?
No, I just give them $20 at the counter.
I've thought about doing that, but yeah, I just usually do the randomizer.
I've only done it once in a while, and whenever I do it, it's there's
my college buddies was big on that. He carried that thing around. And
So he had the same one that he would always
use the same numbers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. He had his lucky numbers or whatever you want to say. And so whenever
they weren't lucky enough, or
I don't think he's won yet. I don't know if he still does it.
Yeah.
That was years ago, but
that's a good way to, because you're right, you can keep it and then just have those.
I mean, your chances are probably better playing, you know, a set of numbers versus just randomizing all the time.
From what I've heard, the randomizing, because we tend to use numbers 30 and less, because they're dates in general.
Yep.
So numbers 31 to, I think, goes to, 55, aren't you, like, if you're going to. Less people's lucky numbers are those.
Unless you were a football player, then maybe your jersey.
Correct. So you could. So maybe what I'm saying is, if as long as you make sure you use the full range, it's probably fine. But
when I was reading a thing that your odds. I don't remember how many years ago, but your odds actually went down because they added 10 more numbers.
I was wondering how these jackpots got that much higher lately, and that makes sense as you
added more numbers to it. Or whatever it was.
I mean, either way, it's not great. There was that movie came out a couple of years ago about people like figuring out the lottery. Like, you had to spend X amount of dollars, and then your rate of return. You had to spend like $5,000 or something.
So if I spend $20,000 versus $20, I'll have a better.
Right, you have a better chance of breaking even or making it ahead. And that was supposedly based on a true story. I never actually watched the movie, but.
So if there's no podcast next week, you know we won the jackpot?
Right. Yep.
Sure.
And then everyone will be calling your number.
Yes. I don't know if our deal is still standing, but about 15 years ago, a farmer, that must have been when the jackpots were getting high.
Do you have to marry somebody?
No, he had it worked out of like, Because I said, basically I told him, like, if I win, I wouldn't, it'd just be hard because if people knew you'd win, you'd lose all your friends and stuff. It would just be tricky. And he and I made a deal on a handshake 15 years ago that probably doesn't exist. He doesn't farm at this point anymore either. But he's like, well, if you win, I you know, you just have to pay me $2 million, and I would say I won all of it, and
oh,
we'd be good.
Sure.
That
was
the deal. Take the fall for
he was going to take a percent, and then basically, so yes. So I don't know if you need a fall guy or what, but yeah.
But then if he, then you got to count on him to actually make good on that deal and not just
right. I don't
take
know
the whole thing and be like, yep, I won.
Well, no, right, because I don't know how you'd claim it and then say, well, this guy is technically, you'd have to have him claim it, right.
There are probably a few states where you can. Most states you can't do that.
Right.
You have to. Has to be, like, whoever claims it, there
has,
like,
right, because it's taxed and all that
right.
stuff, yeah.
Because you can't be anonymous in certain states. Like, I think Wisconsin is one where you can't sure. just be anonymous. Because that would be the solution to the problem, is just be like, yeah, I won. You prove it, and then just say, don't publish my name. But there's only a few places
that you
can't.
Yeah. Especially with this big of a winner, they're going to want to publish the
right.
name.
Especially the place that sold it.
Yes, yeah. If you're like on the farm and you won this, what's the first thing that is showing up at your farm door? Like the old, like, if I win the lottery, you wouldn't know, but there'd be signs.
They're
going to
pay
the first...
off all their debt.
I would say they're paying the debt.
Oh, I'm saying like the fun thing. Like, is it a new combine?
Oh, yeah.
Is it a
chopper.
New chopper? Is it just land? Is
yep.
it robots to milk your cows?
Nope.
Is it like...
It's a big tractor. It's a combine. It's a chopper.
See, I'm picturing too, like a
big-ass pickup truck.
Really tripped out
the
UTV
pickup truck.
Or pickup truck. That's what I'm picturing.
It stays
like,
in the garage and like, only gets brought out on Sundays.
Like your first purchase to me is probably, you're just driving right to that Ford or Chevy dealer and...
Give me a
yeah,
100 grand
like
truck.
What? Yeah, you got everything on this thing.
Want a one ton with all the options and... Because I don't care about gas mileage anymore.
Right. Wow. And a farm truck, you never really, yeah.
All right. You guys ready to get into it?
Let's do it.
So we're going to talk corn silage, which may or may not be as far as you think it is, depending on what your fields look like. You know, we've been grabbing some samples this week, and a few surprises, a few areas of... fields that are maybe a little bit drier than the rest. So it's kind of been it's not going to be a cut and dry year, I don't think, unless maybe you guys disagree. But
they never are, Matt, so I don't... It depends on... This year the idea was like everything got planted in a very similar
right,
window.
Right, it should all be ready at the
so
same
should
time.
All be ready at the same time, and then it does look like it's going to be pretty much already at the same time, but at the same time it's not, so it's just very tricky that way.
Yeah.
So I've always said, to me, this is the hardest like bullseye to hit. Like, you, the range is so narrow, it's very hard to actually really tell what the moisture, it's a whole plant moisture, so it's just a very tricky
when you're only grabbing hit.
Right, we're grabbing
a small percentage.
Right, you're grabbing a couple plants in a field that has billions of plants
right.
in it, right? And you're going, okay, let's go.
Right. So the way we do it isn't tricky. And then, yeah, you can get a chopper out and do test loads and check that. But that once that chopper's rolling, it just feels like it's hard to stop it. So, yes, so it's just a very, you know, we do a lot of, like, grain moistures for guys as well. And that, I have never had a call where a guy's like, well, were you even in the right spot of the field? Where were you? It was way off. You know, like, my number for that usually is plus or minus, say, 2%.
Right.
I don't know what it is. You know, it's usually close.
Right. But at that point, the whole field is done its thing,
correct.
Right? It's down. This is the hardest part with silage is, like, you guys have walked fields probably even yesterday. Like, you get to a spot, it's completely brown. You walk 30 feet, and it's completely green.
Right.
Like, what do you do?
Right.
You take one from each? Do you take...
No, and I agree with you, Bill. It's just a very... the amount we're grabbing, and I looked up like if there was a rule of thumb that was way better, like if we grab 20 stalks,
yeah,
would it be better? And in general, a lot of it still said 3 to 4 stalks because
20 stalks would suck.
That's all that's manageable as well, right? I mean, say you did 20, even if you could mix that all together properly, which you couldn't.
At that point, you might as well be doing a test load because you're
right. So anyway, that is one of the tricky parts with it. And one hard part is I do get farmers this time of year that almost get to the point, too, is like, wow, why, let's just not even do this. It's a waste of time. And that part, I don't think we got to get to that line either. It's not a waste of time. It's just a tool that you got to really make sure you're watching.
The neat part that I think works well, like I just sent off a large grower's numbers this morning, and they plant 108-day BMR, 101-day BMR, 97-day BMR, 95-day BMR. And they're all different planting dates, but I know that the 108-day is not ready, so I didn't even bother. I did the 101, and I did the 97 because I know the 101 dries down faster than what they say it is. And what it does is it gives them, okay, start in this area. Start at these fields. You know, they got 4,000 acres to chop, but let's start here. You know, don't go over there because that's 72. Go over here because it's 67, 65. So it's you're never going to hit the bullseye, Todd, I don't think.
Right.
That's real.
Right.
And you're going to get within the first or second ring of the dartboard.
Well, that's a good way to say it, Bill, too, is like if our goal is to get a bullseye, if we do hit it, it's just sheer by luck. We're throwing this dart, you know, blindfolded, not with our dominant hand. You know, it'd be like me throwing a left-handed dart 20 feet away, you know, really far, and you're just trying to get it as close as you can at that point. And I agree with you. That's a good way to say it. Like, if you're looking for today's the day, for sure, that's not what these are getting you. These are getting you within a week of when it's ready. And I like what you're saying, too. It does help to take multiple fields so you know which fields are ready first, which are ready in the middle, and which will be ready last.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I like about doing these is getting an idea of the rate of dry down. Because, you know, the standard half a point a day, whatever, isn't always what you get. I mean, we had rain a couple days this week, not a lot of rain, but
depends where you were.
Right. Depending on where you were.
I got almost an inch at home.
Yeah, and here we...
But you go north.
We got a quarter.
Yeah.
Quarter, yeah.
2/10 north.
But it did all still rehydrate.
Right. That dry stalk in those dry areas wicked that right up.
What do you think the wicking adds? And how long does it last? Do you think it's like a fast wick and then within 2 days it's gone again?
It
depends on the weather.
Correct.
If it was hot right now, yeah, it'd probably be a day, maybe two.
It's just a blip, right? It's just,
I've seen it add 2 to 5 points. Usually I say about 2 or 3, it seems like it adds. And then I've also seen that moisture, if we get above 80 or almost 90 degrees, it can leave within a day or two.
Yeah.
Whereas now when the current weather we're experiencing is, you know, highs in the low 60s and that
overcast,
moisture,
you don't have the sun.
Yeah. So that moisture will hold now longer. That is maybe one of the struggles here with this too, is that old adage of half a point a day dry down is good data, and it was real data, but it's so weather dependent on that it doesn't.
You get an 80 day with wind is a lot different than a 60 degree day in clouds.
Right. So to say a half point a day, that works to maybe gauge over a week. But even that, I've had it where if the week isn't the right weather, it's way different than that. So
or it goes up.
Right.
Right. Yeah, it could be on average, or it could be, you know, a point today because it was hot and sunny, and then the next day it cools off and maybe you only get like a quarter point. Yeah, it varies so much, and what percentage of the field is dry versus not dry.
Well, and where you go in the field and grab it, you know, okay, I went in the low spot of the field, it's got some hills, but I didn't get the high spot because it's just the way to go get it is hard. I mean, just the dynamics of and the logistics of getting the sample too. And like you said, Todd, you're not going to carry out 20 stalks.
No,
no one can do that.
To chip up that many to carry that many, it's not.
Yeah, you'd be doing a couple fields a day.
Like you say, Bill, at that point, you'd be better off having a.
But as advisors to our farmers, don't you think the hardest part of this is like the custom harvesting dilemma?
True. You're right.
Yeah. Yep.
The custom harvesting.
When are they going
to
show up?
Right. Like the dynamic of what it takes to get your custom harvester there, the choppers, the maybe you got dump carts now, the trucks, the packing tractors, like all that. Like at least with hay, you can be like, okay, we're going to schedule it and then we just do it. Here it's like if they come and they make one or two passes through the field and go, boys, your numbers are way off. Like it's 73. And then what, are you going to let them leave?
Right.
Right? You don't want to let them leave because it might be 2 weeks before you get them
back.
Right.
And then you're not going to make a half a pile and cover it and then want to uncover. Like that whole dynamic is hard too. So I think that's, for me, it's like, well, when should we tell these guys to show up? That's the hardest part. And they don't want to show up before they're.
No, and these custom crews now are, you know, it's multiple choppers. In general,
right.
Even if it's one chopper, it's still, you know, a couple pack tractors to a lot of pack tractors, and it's a lot of truck drivers that you. So it's just a whole crew of people that you are trying to that these custom guys too are trying to navigate and make sure they know where to go. So maybe a big part too is just trying to communicate with them as much as you can. Let them know what numbers your agronomist is finding for dry out. Let them know where you're at. And just be telling them, like, hey, this is what it's showing us. And then, obviously, they've got a whole bunch of customers to try to figure out how they're going to navigate that. Or usually multiple customers to try to figure out who's going to go first and last.
At least we know if it's too wet, we can stop. The biggest scare I have is if it's too dry, right? We can't put that moisture back.
Right.
You know, you get in the 50s, you're like, oh, we really bombed this one. We really missed it, you know? So that's the hard part about
that. That's with corn silage specifically. I was wondering why this is so different than any other crop, you know, than say even alfalfa, wheat, or the grains, especially the grains is usually I'm not saying they can't get too dry, because they can. We've had beans get too dry. You know,
yeah.
It can happen.
Or corn that's too dry and it's shelling.
You can get docked and you can have problems. But usually you see it coming and it's over a long, you know, you have a longer span. This when it gets too dry, it can happen over a couple of days where it also goes from being that perfect to too dry. So your window is a lot tighter. And it's just harder to tell when it's ready. Like we just said, we're more accurate with the grain samples and this. We're less accurate and the window's smaller. So all things considered, it just makes it a more difficult thing to really try to hit. And then I also think when guys switched, you know, back in the day when it was silos, you wanted it pretty dry. I mean, that corn was pretty much black layer corn.
Yeah.
So black layer corn is much different too to know when it's right. You know, black layer is pretty evident. So Bill, I remember you and I chopping, putting it into a concrete silo. And
oh, yeah.
It was October.
Yeah, the Badgers, you know, had four games under there. I remember chopping on a Saturday, listening to a Badger game, and they were in the Big Ten play.
Yeah.
Like, I remember just,
I mean, you were,
like, random, but I remember them playing Purdue and Mike Allstott. Like, just, I don't know why I remember
Mike
that,
Allstott,
but
that's a long time ago.
But, like,
yeah.
But they weren't playing Purdue in August here. They're playing them in.
So say
September, October.
20, 30 years ago, that window was different because it was a different corn you were harvesting. You were harvesting black layer mature corn.
Well, you probably weren't planting it in early May either.
No, and you worried about frost because frost could really hammer you then.
Right.
Because you're that late. Then we switched, say, sort of to like bags in general, on the ground bags. And that window is huge. It's 60 to 70%. And it's huge. Like,
right.
It's a big window and it seems like, no matter where you are in that window, it's fine. Then once we switched into bunkers and piles, that window to me now is, it depends on the nutritionist, depends on the farm, what they want. But in general, if it's under 62, it's too dry.
Yeah.
if it's touching 60%, we miss the window big time. And the goal probably is what, 64 to 67, yep. somewhere in yep. there. And it, so anyway, what I'm getting at to is that the product we're chopping today is different. We're using custom harvesters. That's different. The window that we've got is much more narrower to get it. So it's just being on top of it is more important.
Matt, you know what else we weren't doing 30 years ago?
Putting it on a pile.
Well, that, but planting corn in a hurry.
Right.
Uncle Carl was planting with a four-row.
Yeah, you were probably
planter back then when Todd and I were talking about this chopping.
Well, and you couldn't chop. You were chopping with probably a three-row.
Ooh, no, two-row.
Two-row pull-typer, yeah.
Two-row pull-type.
So, yeah, you weren't getting through the acres. It was good that you weren't planting.
Yeah,
in a hurry,
because
if it was already at the same time, but you were screwed.
I know I've said this before on the podcast, but I just think about my grandpa, what he would think about these choppers that take 12 rows or whatever it is, 8 to 12
8
rows.
8 to 12, but a lot of them are 12. And
just mowing stuff down.
And going fast, you know, and through a kernel processor now. So our old Gale 1250 did not have a kernel processor that was shoving that much feed through that tiny little area to get through. So you're right. It's kind of unbelievable.
Yeah, a lot has changed in 30 years. But you know, we can get an idea, we can help narrow it in. And we're not just using the moisture. We're looking at cobs and seeing maturity of the cob too. And like whenever I pull samples, I'm sure you guys do it too, is I usually pull a cob and look at the cob too and make sure
milk line, very important.
Milk line is,
I mean, there is some consultants out there that only use milk line,
right? Only visually.
I had a farmer this week say, like, why even do this, just go switch back to using milk line. And again, that's a good indicator, but I like both because then I can use milk line to help me.
But how many regular, like, take out BMR, but how many regular corns that we're chopping, we're trying to keep that plant green.
Right.
Right. We're trying to keep the plant green so that we can harvest a green plant. But when we're combining, right, the kernel, the cob might not match up to the plant maturity because of the genetics and how we're hoping these plants dry down over time to stay healthier at harvest. And you got a dry cob, but a healthier stalk to stand better. So that's tough too, Todd. The chopper is the best, right? Just take a swipe down the middle of the field or wherever you want, and then you know.
Right.
I do feel like sometimes, like, our chipper just doesn't do as good of a job, too, right?
It's that conversation and talking with Derek on the research side, too, of different tools we could, because that's, so we've used chipper shredders as a proxy to size it, and I would agree with you, Bill, that the chipper shredder is not ideal. It is not a chopper. It's not got multiple blades along a shear bar that, it, you know, it's just a couple knives and a thing that's supposed to be made to cut up wood.
Right.
So it can get stringy. It is not ideal. We were looking up stuff yesterday on these Chinese made things where guys were putting sorghum through them, and there was this, you know, just a standalone unit like a chipper. But so sooner or later, hopefully we can get a better machine that it is more easily available and can do it. I agree with you. Right now, in our system, I believe that our biggest problem is the way we're chipping, is the chipper itself. Mm-hmm. That whole sit, and I don't care what chipper. There is some that are better than others, but it is still not the way to.
Right,
it's not the same as a chopper. Yeah. It's not the same at all.
No. And what are corn chips better than drier corn?
Right. So, right. So as it gets drier, it does. It's even worse mm-hmm. of a sample you get. It just doesn't work as well. Yeah, you're right. You're right, Bill. And what do you guys think the best? You know, is coster tester, dehydrators. Air fryers is one thing guys are using now. What have you seen as the best tool to actually dry down the sample? Does it got to go to the lab? You know, is there a...
I think they're all fine. I think it's just how much hand-holding and babysitting do you want to do. I don't like the microwave because I think you overcook it and burn it.
Yeah.
Really, like, too easily. So I don't... like that. I mean, Coster testers are fine, but
it comes out of time. Like your dehydrator, you're leaving in longer. Your Coster tester's faster. Air fryer, I don't know. I've never tried the air fryer.
I've got a cheap air fryer I've bought and use it. It's to me, it's similar to the microwave.
Sure.
More than the, I thought it'd be more similar to a
Coster tester
because it's just basically a heat element with air.
Right.
But Coster tester blows it from the bottom up and seems to kind of work well. I can't think of any other air fryers that maybe mine's just different. But the one I got blows it from the top down, and it just doesn't quite. You do set it for 30 minutes and walk away. But I have had it where you can burn the middle of the sample if you're not careful, and it's just the tricky. To me, Coster tester and lab are the best at the top. Then dehydrator is a very close second. I think it depends how you make. Just to me, on a Coster, you can just chuck some in there and it'll be fine. Where a dehydrator, you do got to watch how you put it on the tray and what you're doing, and have multiple samples to kind of confer with each other.
And we're at our peak. We're doing 40 to 60 samples a day.
Right.
There's no way we could.
No, you couldn't
tend to Coster.
Even the electricity costs would be just nuts.
You'd have to have 10 Costers going.
Right.
And then still, it'd be.
And I think that's why it's because enough labs use microwaves because they could have somebody just sitting there chucking samples in and watching it and doing it right. Because you're right. If you do it right, they're fine. So
I'm not saying a microwave is bad. I just think it's easy to.
To not do it right.
Do it right, yeah.
It's better to be consistent, though, and use the same method
when it you're is.
Looking across as opposed to trying to switch it up. That's give you the problem sometimes is guys go to a dry down and they're like, oh, it was this, but you said it was this. And it's like, well.
We're using a Coster and then the dry down's over, so they send them the rest to the lab, which is what they have to do, but it's still.
Right. So, all in all, we're not trying to be precise to the point of like, yep, this is exactly what the moisture is. If you're not chopping in 37 minutes, you're missing the window. It's not the point of any of this. It's just to have an idea to look at, like we mentioned before, where's the moisture at? What's the rate of dry down? What other factors are coming in? You know, what do the cobs look like? What's the milk line at?
There's some target fields that we can get going on.
Right.
Or ones we can wait. Like, that's good to know. Like, we can wait.
Yeah, we're not going to buy a chopper and just roll up to your farm and do a test load for you. No,
unfortunately not.
That would be a good.
Me and Derek have looked at that,
have
too.
You?
Like a one-row chopper that you could just go peel through some fields. The logistics and the. It didn't work for what you'd have to charge a farm to get that information. So it's just sometimes this is hard where it's like, what could we do to make it better? And I think we'll get there. But Matt, you remember the days we the corn was going to sit in the back of the truck for probably 3-4 hours. Oh. But remember when we built that cooler system?
Yep.
Like we had to
keep the truck bed cooler.
We had it like so it had the tonneau cover, and then we didn't want them to dry down sitting in the back of the truck was the idea. So we built a little fan cooler that kept it cool back there. It probably didn't in the end. You know, just all these little things we're trying to do to get better, and I still think we haven't really done anything that much different than we did 15 years ago. So hopefully, like I said, my new push right now is the chipper, is finding a new machine that's more like a chopper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To put these samples through and get it sized correctly. I still haven't been able to find that correct machine, and maybe it's taking an old one row New Holland and converting it down, but there again it's where's the data we're getting worth all of the extra work and cost to get that data
right. All right, so there's some ideas what to look at when doing a corn silage dry down and how to take that data. And really it comes down to, when is your custom harvest crew coming? And where are you in the pecking order, and how long can you wait before things get too dry? So, all right, now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So some new soybean products at the Farm Progress Show down in Decatur, Illinois. It was just the last couple weeks here. So there was a soybean herbicide six-pack trait stack. Syngenta and MS Technologies announced a soybean trait stack that will offer tolerance to six herbicide active ingredients, more than any other soybean trait stack in the market. The yet-unnamed trait combination will include tolerance to glyphosate, glufosinate, 2,4-D, choline from the Enlist E3 platform paired with FG72 event that confers tolerance to three HPPD inhibitor chemistries, mesotrione, bicyclopyrone, and isoxaflutol. Pending regulatory approval, the trait stack is expected to be available in introductory volumes in 2028 with broad market available in 2029. So be Acuron soybeans almost.
Does that tell you that there's more of a carryover problem than we'd like to admit? Does that tell you that or not? When I read that headline of adding mesotrione, which is Callisto, bicyclopyrone, which is
in Acuron,
is a part of Acuron, we're probably not going to use those in beans necessarily. I mean, you could. I'm not saying you wouldn't. Or
well, that's the intent, right? Then we can kill our water hemp.
Right. I think it's correct. as much what you're thinking as it is
correct.
Make spraying beans easier.
I'm just saying, does that infer that?
Because that was the idea of the Enlist platform in general, is Enlist corn and beans, where you could do both, and having the same.
That'd be a fun side by side on a full rate. You know, Callisto bicycle program previously on corn, and then you go side by side with beans that are and are not tolerant, and just see. But yes, okay.
So yeah, Barron BASF also had some new pre-emergent herbicide products that they're looking to bring to market. So in June, EPA announced proposed registrations for two herbicides, diflufenican, which is the active ingredient in Bayer's Conventro, and triflutamoxazin, one of two active ingredients in BASF's Varaxor. Public comment periods for both herbicides closed in July. So Conventro is a group 12 herbicide and molecule that is new to North American market. Triflutamoxazin and safluenosil, both group 14 PPO inhibitors, are the active ingredients in Varaxor. So it's sharpen on steroids, how they put it. So that some new potential options there in 2026, pending final approvals. And finally, soybeans that signal sickness. So while soybean plants can't talk to you, one company has developed a system that allows them to communicate when they're sick long before the farmer might see the issue. So California-based Interplant has created Crop Voice, which is essentially an early warning system for detecting fungus in the field using genetically engineered plants in a sentinel plot network. So once a fungal infection is detected, an alert goes out to farmers subscribed to the Crop Voice network. Takes the guesswork out of your fungicide applications. Might be weeks before you're able to see the symptoms, but as we know, by the time you're seeing it, it's usually too late. So not only can fungicide applications be made sooner when needed, but they can also be avoided when disease isn't present. This crop season, the Crop Voice Network spanned 50,000 acres in Illinois and Nebraska. In 2026, it'll expand to 500,000 acres across Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. So some interesting things coming in the soybean world. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So the Farm Progress Show is the nation's largest outdoor farm event, annually hosting over 600 exhibitors from around the world. Every year, the Farm Progress Show connects thousands of producers with companies that are pushing the boundaries of innovation in agriculture. The best place to see what's next for agriculture. Prairie Farmer magazine, a flagship of Farm Progress companies, was instrumental in the development of the Farm Progress Show. Early in 1953, Prairie Farmer joined forces with WLS Radio in Chicago with the idea to host a farm event better than mechanical corn picking contests around the Midwest. It's this group that was credited with the creating The idea of hosting a field day where farms could see firsthand the progress being made in farming equipment, along with seed varieties and ag chemicals. The first farm show, farm progress show, took place on October 2nd, 1953, on the Earl Bass Farm in Armstrong, Illinois, and hosted over 75,000 visitors. This show offered folks an opportunity to see equipment, seed, and chemicals, as well as firefighting demonstrations, sheepdog trials, stage entertainment, a fiddler's contest, and even the WLS barn dance. In subsequent years, the show evolved to include seed test plots and field demonstrations. While the programs have changed through the years, they've stayed true to American agriculture and to bringing the best of American agriculture to the audience. The 2005 show marked the first at its permanent biennial Decatur, Illinois site, hosted more than 500 exhibitors. Decatur site was expanded for the 2007 show to host more than 600 exhibitors and record number of show visitors. The latest milestone for the show occurred with the establishment of the second feature-filled permanent site near Boone, Iowa. The show now rotates between Decatur and Boone sites and offers two excellent long-term weather-resistant facilities for the nation's largest outdoor farm show. Both show locations have been designed with highly developed infrastructures and conveniences for exhibitors and show visitors. I know somebody was telling me that they purposely designed them for drainage and everything, so parking lots can still get muddy, but it's not the wet hole that some farm fields can turn into in bad years. So, yeah, have you guys, either of you guys ever been to the Farm Progress Show? I have not.
Never. New.
No, it's...
I mean, Decatur's really not that far. I mean, it's far enough, but I think it's like five or 6 hours.
I'd say it wouldn't be a bad... both of those spots are neat spots because they're fairly...
I'm not sure where Boone is in Iowa. I'm not that familiar.
It's kind of closer to... Yeah, for us to Decatur is... 5 hours, 5.5 hours. So that's not.
It's not that bad.
6.5 to Boone.
And
oh yeah, so Ames would be near like Ames, Iowa.
Yep. I do think it's neat when they have it in Illinois. There's a Half Century Show that's like every other year in Rantoul. Okay. It's like another show.
That just happened.
Right, because they kind of coincide.
That's when they do the harvest.
Right, thing, they do like older equipment. And just
that's a cool area.
Have you been there?
I've had a couple farms that actually go down to that show.
Yeah.
It's a like right in the middle of
just you're talking
Illinois
farm country.
It's like giant fields. We played ball there this summer. And
that would be, like, if you think of, like, Midwest corn epicenter.
Boom.
It's right that.
It's Rantoul. Yeah. Not a cool city. Like, it's kind of a dumpy city, but.
Well, that's it's got to be.
Well, from what I've heard about, what's neat about the show is you basically get a golf cart and you just drive around and look at all the different.
It's on an old military
base. Well, yeah. No, it sounds like it, from what I know too, it's used during the year. It's an airport for certain stuff that just they shut it down for the show.
Yeah.
Do you guys ever miss it called, I don't know when Wisconsin changed to Farm Technology Days versus Progress. I don't remember exactly, but do you miss it being called like
Farm Progress Days?
Farm Progress Days, or do you think like people still call it that once?
I mean, progress and technology kind of go, I mean, they're not all that dissimilar, I guess, in what the meaning is meant to be. So,
right.
It was just a rebrand type thing.
All right. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our farmers out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. Just search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts. Or on your Android phone, download an app like Podcast Addict. And there you can search Tilth Talk Radio. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts. And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll get to our cool beans. That's current corny and some current events. So cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans. Our cool beans this week. 36 Wisconsin FFA members are honored at the national level for their proficiency projects. So Wisconsin FFA members advancing in the national stage in agricultural proficiency contest were recognized for their hard work and skill development in their projects on the national level. The Agricultural Proficiency Awards honor FFA members who, through supervised agriculture experiences, have developed special skills that they can apply toward their future careers. Nationally, students can compete for awards in nearly 50 areas ranging from agricultural communications to wildlife management. Proficiency awards are also recognized at local and state levels and provide recognition to members who are exploring and becoming established in their agricultural career pathways. Of the 36 Wisconsin members selected as state champions in their respective division, 11 were awarded gold ratings, while 15 earned silver ratings. The 10 remaining FFA members were designated as national finalists and will advance to the final competition at the 98th National FFA Convention and Expo to be held October 29th through November 1st, 2025, in Indianapolis, Indiana. The following national finalists will move on in competition. So we've got Cammie Elsom from Wisconsin Dells for poultry production, Brynna Goplin, Whitehall, for swine production, Zoe Gross from Columbus for veterinary science, Marshall Kleiman, Granton, for dairy production, Josie Lau, Ithaca, FFA, for equine science entrepreneurship, Tyler Luke from Wanakee for ag services, Ava Meadow, Wittenberg Burnhamwood, goat production, Riley Nelson, Wapaka Environmental Science and Natural Resource, Hannah Olson, Adams Friendship for beef production, and Jacob Rome from Seymour, Wisconsin for ag mechanics, repair, and maintenance. So
Tilt's own.
Tilt's employee.
Shout out to Jacob, yeah. Good luck down at Nationals, and it's really cool.
So yeah, those finalists will move on for their competition down in Indianapolis, so that's very cool for them. Our That's Corny This Week. Environmental groups are motioning for court to pull in list.
Wah, wah. So,
gee, where have we heard this song and dance before? Environmental groups are looking to the federal courts to revoke Enlist herbicide registrations. They want to vacate the herbicide registration for Enlist One and Enlist Duo, alleging in a motion for summary judgment that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency understated associated health risks, overstated the product's effectiveness in combating weeds, and set ineffective mitigation measures in an ongoing lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Corteva Agriscience's Enlist 1 contains 2,4-D, while Enlist Duo contains both 2,4-D and glyphosate, which are applied to genetically engineered corn, soybeans, and cotton to combat weeds. EPA tilted the scales decisively in favor of continued registration of these controversial herbicides by systematically ignoring and/or minimizing their costs, while also inflating the claimed benefits, according to the Center for Food Safety and other plaintiffs in the lawsuit, for said in their motion. So the motion for summary judgment is a request asking for the court to rule in favor of one party without a full trial, when there is genuinely no dispute about the facts in the case. As part of the motion, the center said the EPA relied on 2018 and 2019 Enlist usage data, although Enlist soybean adoption went from negligible to 35% of U.S. acreage in 2021. So we'll have to kind of see where things go on that one, but looks like EPA has until October 20th of this year to file a response in opposition to the motion and any cross motions for summary judgment. In addition, Corteva will have until November 3rd to file its response. So, won't be immediate, but it could be something to watch over the winter here. And now we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. Incredible hoard of 51 Native American blades were discovered in a Missouri soybean field. In June of this year, Ben McGee uncovered an amazing treasure untouched for over 2,000 years. So Ben McGee, when his eyes were locked on the treasure that had been buried for 2,000 years, couldn't speak or move. Just beyond his reach, a trio of biface blades peeked out of magical dirt, a mere fraction of one of the greatest Native American finds in recent history. Shaking off the shock, he stood on an isolated farmland in northeast Missouri with the implications rolling over. Was there more to be found underneath? So he dug out 51 shirt blades, which had been untouched for millennia, and the find of a lifetime. So he said his adrenaline still jumps talking about it. It took 5 months to locate the cache of blades, but the signs were all there from the start, almost like the field was talking to me and he just had to listen.
What does it tell you? I don't
know. What's that?
What is it telling him that he is?
He knew that it was a good spot for blades. A lot of times, I imagine it sounds like the field was near a creek.
So sure.
You lock farmland or a creek, look with your eyes, but with a feeling, he said. And so he's a hunter of artifacts, and so that gives him a little bit more experience with it. He was raised on gravel in heavy farm country northeast of St. Louis and Lincoln in Warren counties. He caught the artifact infection as a 5-year-old, enchanted by a stone tool that his father found, and picked the brain of all my elders trying to learn about what was under farmland. We were surrounded by farms and old timers telling me let him onto their fields, and they took time to teach him how to look, where to look, and why. When he got into his teens, he worked on farms and kept building a network of private land, learning the whole time. And so his find here was very important to him, and so it's kind of a cool thing. I mean, we've had a few of our fellow agronomists find arrowheads over the years, but I don't think anybody's found something this big.
No, they're huge. These are cool looking.
Yeah. So they were 4.5 inches wide by 3 inches, or long by 3 inches wide, roughly. It's a lot of them. So, yeah, pretty big stuff. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about corn silage dry down and what to expect and how to look for some signs that the fields are drying. In our spotlight, we talked about new soybean products found at the Farm Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of that Farm Progress Show that is held in 2 different locations, one in Iowa, one in Illinois, every other year. Cool beans this week, 36 FFA members honored at the national level for their proficiency products. Our That's Corny was environmental groups motioning to pull Enlist from use. And our Field Good Friday was an incredible find of 51 Native American blades in a Missouri farm field. Thanks for listening. As always, happy farming.